Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special episode of The Decade Project on One Heatman Productions podcast. This is the project where we put a line in the sand and say, what are the films a decade ago that are still hanging around in our consciousness? Because we are like flooded with different films that come on streamers, etc. But I like to sort of pause and reflect on 10 years ago, the things that are still hanging around. This is an extra special bonus episode that you're all hearing on the main feed of The Decade Project, which usually lives on our Patreon for most of the year. But I'm bringing this one to the main feed because it's extra, extra special to talk to one of the filmmakers involved. The man I'm talking to is an Academy Award-winning writer behind a absolutely sensational, thrilling, historical drama, thriller. It's kind of defies like easy classification, but the film is just tighter than a watch, is edited to perfection, has incredible performances. And the man I'm speaking to today is, of course, Graham Moore, the writer of The Imitation Game.
This war, we're not winning it. If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed for high treason.
Who are you?
Alan Turing, one of the best mathematicians in the world.
Welcome to Enigma.
It's the greatest encryption device in history. The Germans use it for all major communications. Over 159 million, million, million possible settings.
It's unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many have died because of Enigma?
Three. While we've been having this conversation.
Churchill's put Alan in charge.
Keith and Charles both fired.
Popular at school, eh?
We're short on staff.
We get more staff.
You have 6 minutes to complete the task.
Is that even possible?
It takes me 8. 5 minutes and 34 seconds.
You said to do it in under 6. What is it that we're really doing?
We're going to break an unbreakable Nazi code and win the war.
Oh.
To pull off this genius routine, one actually has to be a genius.
It doesn't matter how smart you are. Enigma is always smarter.
What if only a machine can defeat another machine?
Have you decrypted a single German message?
My machine will work.
Sooner or later, you will make a mistake.
What if I don't fancy Joan in that way?
It's illegal. They are looking for any excuse to put you away.
You've got more secrets than the best.
Am I a criminal? Am I a war hero?
You don't get to decide who lives and who dies.
No one else can.
You will never understand the importance of what I am creating here.
Alan!
My God.
Yes!
Sometimes it is the people who no one imagines anything of who do the things that no one can imagine.
So rarely do I get to talk to a filmmaker about a film of theirs 10 years ago. Usually I ask my guests, Graham, you know, do you remember what it was like 10 years ago? Do you remember what it was, actually this all happening and coming together? Tell me about your response to the film. But as the writer of it, this is probably with you for much longer than 10 years. So firstly, thank you for being a part of the show with us. And thank you for coming back to sort of reminisce about your incredible work.
Thank you, Blake. I really appreciate it. That's so kind. It is honestly, if you'd have told me not 10 years ago, but gosh, 15, that anyone would still be talking about this movie, this script that I wrote on spec, you know, back in 2010, I would be more than shocked. So this is, that we get to keep talking about this is quite a thrill. So thank you for continuing to talk about it.
So can you, like, before we get back, one of the things that I want to say is, so there's a great Australian film critic by the name of David Stratton, who was like one of our big critics at the time. He said of this movie, he goes, what could have been a very dry and earnest film emerges under the intelligent direction of Norwegian Morten Tildum, working from a screenplay from Graham Moore, a gripping and still rather extraordinary story. And I feel like that is a great phrase to start with. It's kind of extraordinary, but like, let's go back. We're going even further back than a decade, but let's go back to what were the original motivations for you to write this? How did you learn about Alan Turing? What was your interest? How did this all start? Because I think it's going to be so fascinating to then carry through to like how it gets picked up, how it was received, all those things with you. So how did this start? You said you wrote it on spec. So for folks who are listening, if you don't know what that means, it's not that you have been funded to write it. You're writing it to write it. You're writing it to put it out there. You're writing it off your own bat. So tell us about how it emerged for you, how Alan Turing inspired you to start this script.
I think you may have some trouble believing this, seeing me now, but believe it or not, way back when I was in high school and junior high, I was just a total loser. Like, it's just an incredible, profound loser. And I didn't have a lot of friends. And I was a huge nerd. I went to space camp. I went to computer programming camp. I was that kid. And so I think among a certain set of kids growing up in the 90s in Chicago, as I did, going to, you know, computer programming camp, Alan Turing was kind of this campfire legend. He felt like this figure we'd all kind of heard about. Oh, did you know that the guy who invented the computer was gay and no one knew? And in fact, he was principally involved in breaking the German Enigma code during the Second World War. And he used his pioneering computer work to do so. And he was persecuted by his government after the fact. I mean, it was sort of this amazing story that seemed like a campfire legend because it seemed too incredible to be true. So I'd known the story. Honestly, I'd felt like I'd known the story my whole life. And I'd always, over the years, you know, thought about it. I talked to friends about it obsessively. I got a little bit older and kind of moving out of my teenage years, quickly found that I was not a good computer programmer. I was not going to go into computer sciences. And I think so much of my 20s were this process of trying, I think like so many of us were kind of going, all right, what do we want to do with our lives? You know, there's like this Venn diagram of things that we think, in a Venn diagram, there's sort of three circles. The one circle of things we think are interesting, things we seem to have any aptitude for, and then the third circle would be things someone will pay us to do. So we can pay our rent. And you're like trying to find something that at least is in two of those three circles, right? And so I quickly found computer programming, I was bad. I was just really bad at it. And then I thought I wanted to be a journalist. And then I was really, really bad at it. Just really bad. And I was surrounded by people who were good. So I quickly realized that was not going to be my thing and I should let the people who are good at it go do that. And so then I started writing fiction and getting into writing some screenplays and started working on what would become my first novel. And, you know, sort of throughout my 20s, I was starting to write. I would always, at least once a year or so, probably harangue a friend over drinks and say, do you know the story of Alan Turing? Isn't it crazy that no one's ever written a movie about Alan Turing? This is insane. How come this is never? It's such a great story. Here's the story. And everyone would kind of go, oh yeah, that sounds like a fascinating story. Is it really a movie though? It sounds kind of talky and dry. You just used the word dry, which I think I have a joke with a friend that still to this day, he sort of says, well, everything you do sounds like it should be the most boring thing in the world. And then you sort of, your whole like thing is taking things that should be so boring and making them actually quite sort of white knuckle thrilling. And then he always says, well, you know, have you ever thought about trying to pick a topic that sounds exciting from the beginning? And then maybe your job would get a bit easier. That seems like not my lot in life.
It's counterintuitive, mate. It's counterintuitive to your process. Yeah. You just got to follow. You got your own process. I'm much like you creatively. I listen to the wind. There's no rhyme or reason. It's instinct. And if whatever you're drawn to, if that's what you're drawn to, then you're doing it right. There's no two ways about it.
I think that is a kind way of looking at it. And certainly that was my experience of saying, you know, when you say, oh, it's this kind of wartime thriller about a mathematician, everyone's sort of going, yeah, the mathematician, really, how's it going to work? But the story had stuck with me so much over the years. And then, but I never started writing. And I did not even think that it was something I could do, frankly, until I'd moved to LA in, 2009. And trying to find a job, and I ended up getting invited to this party. I think, honestly, I don't even think they meant to invite me. I think like they tried to email a different Graham, and I ended up email autocomplete thing. And somehow I showed up at this party of a woman who's become my good friend, Nora Grossman. And she, I met her briefly before, and I remember finding her in the kitchen of her house and saying, oh, hey, it's Graham, who you may have intended to invite to this party. thanks for having me. You know, what are you up to? And she sort of, she was, I think, had just gotten her first job as an executive in Hollywood somewhere. She said, you know, I really want to be, I want to produce independent films. Like, that's what I want to do with my life. And in fact, my friend Ito and I have just, we've saved up $2,000 to option our very first book. And we're going to try and make a film out of it. And I said, oh my God, have a glass. Cheers. Congratulations. That's so cool. Like, you bought the rights to a book. That's amazing. What's the book about? And she said, it's a biography of this mathematician. You've never heard of him. Don't worry about it. And I said, well, I know some things about math. You know, who is it? And then she said, Alan Turing. And I accosted her in her own kitchen and said, oh my God, I wanted to write about Alan Turing since I was a kid. I will do anything to write this movie. And then I basically just browbeat her into letting me come on and start working on it. And so, you know, it was just sort of, my first novel was coming out. I was really excited about that. That seemed like it was going to do well enough that I could sort of afford to take 6 months off and just write whatever I wanted with kind of no one else paying attention. And so we just set off and started doing it. And I just started researching and writing. And it was very, you know, we didn't know. I had never made a movie before. She had never made a movie before. No one knew what they were doing. There was something very kind of zen, like beginner's mind about the whole thing, because no one had any idea what they were doing.
So you do this, you write this spec. It's all just, it just seems so funny that you're the guy who's browbeating everyone. And she's like, oh, it's a mathematician you've never heard of. She's giving you your own pitch of like, yeah, oh, you've never heard of this mathematician. She's giving you the pitch that you've said to like 1,000 other of your friends at different parties forever. And it seems like there are so many of those wonderful like Hollywood dream wish fulfillment stories. And that's like, that's a 10 out of 10, Graham. That's amazing. Like you're just being polite because you thought you were not meant to be invited to a party, and you scored a job that would like define what your path was going to be for the coming years. That's amazing.
It is in some profound way. It is crazy to look back on that and say, if we hadn't had those conversations. And I think that's been, you know, one of the exciting things about being out in the world and getting to make things is you get to hopefully meet other people who are excited about the same strange things that you're excited about. I mean, yes. I think about it for what you do in this podcast and all the podcasts you've made, like you get to go find people who have the same bizarre obsessions that you do. And there's nothing like, I don't need to tell you this, you know better than anyone, that there is nothing like the intense conversation between two people who share the same bizarre obsession.
This is exactly, it's like fuel to the fire. There's nothing like it. It's better than any drug. It's like, oh my God, I found another one. It's such a relief. I found another one. Yes. I can't wait to talk to this person. Another obsessive just like me. It's the best.
I think about that so much. I mean, so much of my life, I feel like, has been trying to find those people, getting excited to find those people. I mean, I think of so much of my, even if you look at the sort of the work I've done, my books or the couple movies I made, you know, it's so much about like, it's like I got really excited about this thing and I'm trying to communicate to an audience why I'm so excited about it. Like I'm trying to get other people to care about the same song that I heard one time on the radio and has just been circling in my brain day after day after day for years ever since.
Oh, that's so wonderful. So you write this thing, beginner's hive mind happens. When do you realize you have something? Because there's one thing sitting down to write it, and I know as a novelist, you kind of know, like I've got a friend, my best friend Maria Lewis, she's a screenwriter and an author, and she's a prolific writer too, so she kind of knows when something's done. And I've asked her many times, like, how do you know when it's done, or how do you know when you have it? And I just wonder for you as a novelist, different to a screenwriter necessarily, you're sitting there like, when do you know that you've got it? Like, when is there a turning point that happens when you're there and you're like, oh, I think we've got this. I think we've cracked it. I think we've cracked the story. I think we've cracked the approach. And I think that this is a, you know, this is a complete thing. This is something that actually goes from a conceptual, I'm going to take some time off and try this, to actually, this could be a movie and we could make this.
I don't, in some ways, it's like this morning, you know, that when I first realized that, like, it didn't work. I don't know. It felt like it was working. There were times it felt like it was working. There were times it felt like it wasn't working. You know, we never stopped changing it. You know, our editor, Billy Goldenberg, has become a dear friend of mine, who you know well because he edited Heat, and which is one of the reasons I was so excited to work with him. And he, you know, we would, I see Billy all the time now, and we still every now and then something with Imitation comes up, and we're always like, did that scene end up in the movie? Did we, I can't remember what the final cut was. Did we leave that line in? Did we take it out? You know, we just went through so many versions of it. So you still, I'm still not even sure, frankly, about what we landed on a bunch of points. But I think I will say that there were a couple moments for me when I knew it felt like, okay, this is the thing I want to do. And like, this is what I have no idea whether anyone else is going to like this thing, but I know I love it. And certainly the first moment was, I guess, kind of early on in the writing process. I knew the story a little bit, and I sort of, I think in our first conversations, I said, I think I quickly went back and read, there's been a bunch of biographies of Alan Turing, but I quickly kind of flipped through one just to kind of remind myself of the basics of the story. And I remember going over to Nora's place with Ido, her producing partner, and saying, okay, I think I want to do the idea of three timelines was something very, very quick. Like it was,
Yes.
I actually found my notebook somehow. We were moving not long ago, and I found the notebook with it in it. And the first, my Imitation Game notebook, literally page one, at the top of the page one is three timelines question mark, 20s question mark, 40s question mark, 50s question mark. It is insane to me that that has maintained, like that's still how the movie's structured, even throughout the whole editing process.
That's one of the things I was going to ask you, and I'm so glad that you're answering it, is because that's when I was, my memory of the Imitation Game before revisiting it a couple of times recently to check it out with you. Like, I've been over the last 10 years, so they're, you know, I can't track them and pin them down. I was not as good a Letterboxd user, so I can't go back and have a look at exactly when I watched it again. But what was so clear to me, I was like, man, the stones on this story to just have multiple timelines that are all echoing and rolling into each other, which is in already dense, you know, cryptography, mathematic discussions. I'm like, the stones on the movie to do that, and then to actually really follow through and then harmonize so perfectly together as the story concludes. I was just like, this, for a first time screenwriter, no wonder it got attention. I was like, this is so, like, watertight. And yeah, having a great editor obviously is a huge help.
Yeah, I give Billy a world of credit for, it's one thing to write it, it's another thing to actually make it work. And like, give my friend Mort, who directed it, and my friend Billy, who edited it, a world of credit for helping to make it work and doing so much to make it work. I think, yeah, it was this very, that was one of the very, it was the first thing on page one of my notebooks. It was, okay, I don't want to kind of do a Birth to Death biopic. You know, Alan Turing was so obsessed with codes and puzzles. The whole thing is about codes and puzzles. So the movie should feel kind of like a puzzle, right? Like that's the whole thing you're trying to do in making, why are we making a film about a real person? Like, what's the value of doing that?
Yes.
and why a film. There have been these great books about Alan Turing. There's been great plays about Alan Turing. There's been great novels about Alan Turing. So what are we, if we're making a film about this real person, why are we doing this? And it's to sort of give that sensation of him to an audience, to sort of do something in fundamentally filmic to convey what it is about Alan Turing and Alan Turing's mind that I find so captivating and that we all found so captivating. And this puzzle thing became such a big obsession. So it was like, oh, let's take, very quickly, it was let's take three. If you asked, sometimes I do this exercise actually early in the writing process, but I'll say, I'll imagine sitting down to have a beer with the main character and sort of imagine that the story of the movie was like a, you're sitting down to have a beer with him or her, and they're saying, hey, buddy, I heard this crazy thing happen to you. Can you tell me the story? Well, what happened? What was that thing that happened to you? And you sort of write their monologue. And I did this. And it was like, what would, if you're Alan, if you're asking Alan Turing to tell you about what are the three most kind of meaningful moments in his life, it felt to me like he would, and I don't think he really drank much beer, but if he did, would have said, and he would.
If the foam from the frothy top as Benedict playing Alan like just touches his lip and then he just leaves it there to sit there and get warm on the table, please tell me the story.
Yes, exactly. And I can, yeah, I'm sure Ben would tell it so much more evocatively than I possibly could. But the no, it sort of it felt like, okay, he'd tell you about the first time he fell in love with Christopher Morcom as a teenager in the 20s, and his introduction through Christopher to cryptography. He would tell you about his code-breaking work in the 40s, and he would tell you about the circumstances around his eventual persecution leading to his death at the hand of the government in the 50s. And so, okay, so it felt like, oh, in a traditional kind of, in a traditional film, that would be act one, two, three. Act one would be the 20s, act two would be the 40s, act three would be the 50s. So what if we mix and match? What if we tell what would be the three acts of a normal move of a sort of more conventionally structured film? What if we make each of those acts its own timeline and tell them concurrently? And then we even had a sort of a further conceptual framework where the 20s storyline and the 40s storyline are both precisely told from Ellen's perspective, whereas the 50s
Yes.
story is never told from his perspective.
Yeah.
It's always the perspective of the police investigating him in the 50s, and then at the very end of the 50s storyline is one scene from Keira Knightley. If you think about it, it's actually from Joan, Keira Knightley's
Yeah.
character's perspective. And the idea was that using the three, Alan Turing seemed to have so many internal contradictions. The idea of the three time periods was like, we can, by taking the three acts, chopping them up this way, we can use the, you can build tension by having the time periods contradict each other. So very frequently in the
Yes.
film, you'll learn information in one period that seems to directly contradict something you learn in an immediately following it in another time period. And you're going,
Yes.
which one is true? Which one's real? And that's kind of leading the audience along and sort of solving the puzzle of Alan Turing. It's like he is the puzzle the audience is trying to solve. And I remember sort of we had this whole idea, and I wrote all this stuff in my notebook about it. And you're kind of going, man, this sounds so cool. Is it going to work? Like, is this incomprehensible, right? But it, so it certainly, and I give, you know, I give Nora and Ido a world of credit for, I remember going into their apartment and saying like, so here's the deal, three time periods, blah, blah, blah. I kind of just gave them the speech I just gave you. And I was expecting them to go, what in God's name are you talking about? They said, yep, we get it. We're in. That's awesome. That's super cool. Let's do it. And then, I mean, frankly, in answer to your other question about sort of when it seemed to be working, I remember being really afraid to start the script because it was so, I spent, after kind of getting the basic sort of framework of it, I then spent 6 months just doing research. I didn't want to write anything. I just wanted to do research and fill notebooks after notebooks of research. There was this lost weekend. I tried to teach myself calculus again. That was just a disaster. I don't know why. That's how naive I was, is I thought if I spent a weekend boning up on my calculus, somehow this would help. Like, that's how dumb I was in approaching the story, because that's ridiculous. And then I was so afraid. I was so afraid to start writing it because I knew how much the story meant to me and I knew how much I loved it. And we'd set this crazy high bar with the three time periods and this whole like really, really complicated structure. And I kept having this feeling of like, there's no way I'm smart enough to pull this off. There's no way I can actually kind of deliver on what I've said I'm going to go do. And I was so terrified. And then I remember this very vividly because I was in Scottsdale, Arizona on a book tour for my first novel when it came out. And I got the call from my publishers that the book had been is me on the New York Times bestseller list. I'm like in Scottsdale, Arizona, I'm doing a thing, and my first novel's coming out.
Amazing.
I'm gonna be on the New York Times bestseller list. And I remember bursting into tears alone in a hotel bar in Scottsdale, Arizona, just sobbing, like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is so wonderful. And I'm just sitting here alone, and I ordered a glass of champagne by myself in this hotel bar. It's like no one to celebrate with, and I want to go to the strangers and talk to them about it. And then I remember, like a couple glasses of champagne in, I walked back up to my hotel room and started writing the script. It was like that was the boost of confidence I needed to try to do this thing. And the first thing I wrote was the opening monologue, that the opening voiceover monologue that Alan Turing gives. And I remember writing that monologue that night, and I called a friend of mine and I just said, I just wrote this monologue. This is the tone of the movie. I think this is the best thing I've ever written. And that terrifies me because if everyone else hates it, I'm out. Like if this doesn't, I love this so much. If other people don't love it, I don't know what I'm ever going to be able to do that will please them on this. And somehow that monologue is like word for word, virtually word for word, still in the finished film. Like I didn't imagine that that would kind of so much of a change, but that monologue kind of always stuck. And that was my first moment of, there were others, but that was the first moment of, okay, this is what I want it to be. And I don't know. And that monologue is even, I mean, it's sort of autobiographical in a way, because his opening monologue, he's telling you, he's sort of speaking to the audience and saying, this isn't your version of the story, this is my version of the story.
Yes.
And isn't necessarily the movie that you are going to want it to be. You're not about to hear a story that you want it to be. You're going to hear the story that I want to tell you and live with it or leave. And he even says in the monologue, it's like, get up and leave if you don't want this.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, how I felt to, that was how I felt at the time. Like, this is the story I want to tell. If no one wants this, they can get up and leave.
It feels so cool to have common ground with a great creative like you. On that, because I constantly feel that I'm like, this is what I'm doing. And if you don't like it, don't listen. It's like, this is happening the way that I'm doing it. And it's happening so now. And it's happening exactly the way that I want it. And I love to hear that. That's so amazing. Thank you for
Yeah.
that.
But thank you for that. I mean, I think it's hard to retain that, to remind yourself kind of why you're doing it, right? And that
Yeah.
like you're making the thing that you want to make about the material that you want to be interacting with. And I think you if you worry too much about who you're going to please, you end up sort of not really pleasing anybody and certainly not yourself. And it's one, I mean, I think, you know, you never know. I remain endlessly shocked by what of the things that I write or make people like and people don't like. And there's
Yes.
still part of me, even with Imitation, where certainly that was kind of the most, in some ways, the most success, like kind of commercially successful, bizarrely, of things that I've worked on. And I still have this reaction sometimes. It's like, wait, that was the one?
Yeah.
Really? That was the one that was commercially
The one
successful?
in
That was.
three, the one in three timelines that's told out of sync, but like with a lead mathematician that has a bleak ending.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, a kind of contradictory bleak ending because it's like, the war being won and the destruction of the original Christopher and then hearing about the awfulness that was, that Alan Turing suffered. It's like, yeah, it's like it's a hard thing to just like if you just said what happens in the movie to someone, you're like, yeah, that was really successful. Lots of people felt great about seeing that and watching it again and again. It doesn't seem like it makes sense, but it does.
Yes, remain shocked that it sort of people responded to the movie the way they did. I don't think any of us ever thought, you know, when we were making it that it was going to be No one talked about it like it was something that was going to be this huge commercial success for the reasons you just mentioned. It is so obviously difficult. It ends with the main character, he has this kind of, yes, they win the war, but at what cost? Our protagonist commits suicide. It is not an uplifting film. And it was so, we made it independently. We had a sort of Teddy Schwartzman of Black Bear Pictures, single source financing. They just wrote us a check and came with us to London to go make the movie. So there was no kind of like corporate structure around us. It was just Teddy and his team. We could do whatever we wanted. I think we had a running joke on set that was kind of, oh, is this, are we just gonna end up selling this to PBS? Like, is this gonna be a sort of mass theater movie by the end of it? And are they gonna, is it, or is the three timeline thing gonna be way too complicated for PBS? Like, they're maybe not gonna buy this. Like, the idea even that it was gonna get theatrical distribution was shocking to us at the time.
Well,
No one.
like, so you finish making the script before you guys get funded and you go to London. There's a couple of key players which you have talked about. You've talked about Morton, you've talked about Billy, which we'll get to shortly, but it's like this film that I'd seen of Morton's before Imitation Game was Headhunters, which, if you've never seen it, is a wild, like, deeply, darkly hilarious movie. And if you have.
Let me give a plug for Headhunters here. If you listening to this have not seen Headhunters, I had nothing to do with it. Morton directed that movie before Imitation. I think Headhunters might be Morton's best movie. I know I wrote Imitation, but Headhunters is great.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Headhunters is a terrific film, and it's so visceral, and I adore Headhunters because it's so gruesome and crazy. It's great. It's an excellent movie. I remember seeing it in the theater, having no idea who he was, and I was like, this movie rocks. Why don't more people see this movie? And so seeing his name attached, it's just like, oh my God. So tell me about, like, once the script is done, just before you go off to make it, because I want to get to the reception of the film. But when it was made, you said that once the script was out there was a response. There was clearly a response that whatever you guys had worked on together was resonating, was working, people were showing interest in it. When did it go from people are showing interest to you locking it down and, okay, we've got Morton, we've got Benedict Cumberbatch, we've got Kira, we've got Matthew Good, we've got the core cast there. Obviously, Charles Dance, amazing. But like Steve Waddington, shout out to Last of the Mohicans as Steve Waddington.
Oh,
But
yeah.
it's once you've got all those pieces together, but like, tell me about just that, like, precipice that, like, it's there, it exists, it's being shopped around, and people are showing interest.
Yeah, I mean, there was a year or two in there. It's easy to jump. There's an easy way, like all stories, there's an easy way of telling it where we sent out the script and everyone loved it, which is true. I mean, I think we got to a point where me and Nora and Ito were really happy with the script. I sent it to my then film agent who had, and honestly, at that point, I'd never worked in feature film. So I think she didn't remember she was my agent. It was like, oh, I was kind of a novelist. She maybe said she would represent my film work at some point, but I'd forgotten. And I remember very vividly sending an email saying, hey, I know you barely remember, who I am. I haven't talked to you in years. I wrote the script. I kind of think this is the best thing I've ever written. And this is the work that I want to be doing in the future. Like, this is just writing, this has been a life-changing experience. And this is representative of the work that I would like to devote myself to in the future. And read this. And if you don't like it, totally understand. You don't have to be my agent anymore. Don't worry about it. I'll just go find someone else. This is what I want to do. And I think she wrote back something like, settle down, Tiger. What are you, you're being very overly dramatic about this. Don't worry about it. And I just remember her calling a week later and getting on the phone with her and her saying, this is amazing. Welcome to your career in feature film. And I said, what? Sorry, what did you say? repeat that? What do you mean, welcome to my career in feature film? And she said, just watch. And it was this wild experience where there were suddenly directors on the phone that day and actors, and it turned into kind of quite a hullabaloo of different people getting excited about the script and wanting to do it. And so honestly, what then turned into, so there's the short version of the story, which is, and then 2 years later, we were on set in London. 2 years later, kind of false starts and other versions of things. And, you know, we tried making the movie at a movie studio for a little while. And we found that it was sort of a little too small and strange to do at a movie studio. And I think then we left and went to Black Bear and to Teddy and sort of found a model of making it independently that we'd always loved. And so those big pieces coming together were, I mean, Morton coming on was a really huge deal. You joke about sort of seeing Headhunters and finding it perhaps not the most obvious comp for Imitation Game, being probably because they are two completely different movies in every possible way.
Wildly different. Wildly. And it shows how good he is as a filmmaker. Like the filmmaking chops to make Headhunters and Imitation Game essentially back to back is insane.
It's so wild. And I love Morton. He's become a dear friend. And I think there were a lot of directors we kind of spoke to. I think, you know, actually it was Teddy from Black Bear who called and said, hey, there's this Norwegian director, Morten Tildum, who's going to be in LA next week. Do you want to sit down with him? I think he might be really interesting for Imitation. And I said, I have no, who's Morten Tildum? I hadn't seen Headhunters. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And Teddy said, just watch Headhunters. And will you please sit down with him? And so I watched Headhunters and I called and said, this is wild. This is completely different than Imitation Game. What are you talking about? This is so different. I love it. This is so cool. But it's certainly not an obvious comp. And Teddy said, just sit down with him. And I still will always remember the first moment I met Morton, because he came in 20 minutes late to my office. And if you haven't met Morton, he's like this big Norwegian gentleman with long flowing blonde hair, like, bursts through the door of my office and says, in his thick Norwegian accent, he just says, Braham, it is I, Morton. I am here to direct Imitation Game. And I was like, God, I'll follow
you're
you.
Hired.
I love you. You're hired. I love you so much. And he was great. And Morton very quickly, he got exactly what it was. You know, I think a commonality of his work is Morton's really good at finding kind of humor in unexpected places. Like Headhunters is so violent, but also so funny.
Wildly funny. Like there's a sequence, the car crash in Headhunters, that I will never forget in my life for the humor and the brutality and like just howling with laughter. And if you're on its wavelength, if you're in a theater of people that it's on its wavelength, it's great. But I was seeing it like during the day, and I think there were like pensioners in the screening that I was watching and they just were not into it. And I was howling and they must have thought I was clinically insane. But that's the kind of movie that it is. It's very deeply funny in a very dark, you know, like Coen Brothers-ish, you know, kind of levels of laugh out loud humor, but violence and, you know, weird kind of, it's excellent. Excellent film. Can't recommend it enough.
So remember at some point we were on set of Imitation. I remember Morton turning to me one day and saying, you know, I can't do his Norwegian accent, but it was like, you know, I've noticed in this movie, there are no headshots. And I said, headshots, what do you mean? He said, you know, no one gets shot in the head. And I was like, yes, unlike Headhunters, where that does happen some frequency. But no, I think one of the things I remember my first meeting with Morton so vividly, because he said, one of the things we had been debating a lot was that the script Imitation has a lot of jokes in it. It's oddly funny. And there's this sort of, it actually has this whole structural conceit about it where, the first third of the movie is actually oddly light. Like there's a lot of jokes in the first third, and there are like capital J jokes in the first third of that movie.
Matthew Good is an engine, you know, Hugh Alexander. He's just an engine of like catty jokes. And then you've got, you know, who's your boss? The great Benedict Cumberbatch. Who do you, you know, Winston Churchill. Okay. And then like neck minute, you've got Mark Strong delivering Winston Churchill's directive that he's leading it. You're all sacked. Like, there's some good jokes. They're fun. They're really
fun.
Thank
you. I appreciate that. Yes. And so, as you just said, right, those are like capital J jokes.
Yes.
And then the second third of the movie, there are, it gets a bit more thrillery in tone. There are fewer jokes. And then the final third is just the saddest, bleakest, most depressing thing we could sort of put together. And right. That was very much intentional, that sort of the jokes are up front to make you kind of, you get really invested in these people. So then when the extremely tragic events of the last third occur, hopefully you're emotionally engaged enough to really feel the tragedy of that. I think, you know, one thing we'd had in some conversations is people would come in and say, oh, you know, this is the serious movie, so can you tone down the jokes? And we would say, nah, this would be kind of funny. And Morton was the guy who came in and said, the first thing he said was, this is so funny, and I don't think people realize how funny this is. And he totally got the sort of three-part construction of why the jokes are there. He was like, yes, the first third should be really, really funny, and then the jokes stop. And then yeah. It's not so funny anymore. But like, why those jokes have to stay, and he's really good at, in both Headhunters and Invitation, I would say, at commonalities, that he's so great at finding jokes amid scenes that you might not expect to have jokes in them.
Yes.
And then, you know, certainly I think in conversations about what actor we wanted to make the movie with, there was no, I mean, everyone, it was Benedict Cumberbatch. I mean, there's no, well, that was a short phone call. Like, what else do we need to talk about? Like, it was just... and I give, honestly, again, I'll give Teddy Schwartzman and Morton just a world of credit there. Like, we, all of us, at the time, Benedict had not at the time been the lead in a feature film.
No, he hasn't.
So he'd done Sherlock. He was going to think, I think we were told he was doing Star Trek II as the villain. But that was it. And so I think, you know, everyone said, look, who knows, like, yes, this guy hasn't been the lead of feature films before, but like, there's never been a more perfect actor part pairing that we can think of in the world. Like, he's so obviously perfect for it, and he really wanted to do it. And it was honestly like, Benedict, let's do it. The shortest conversation I've ever had about it.
And so once you have that, you've got this great cast, you go off and make the film, it's made. It's finished. We're doing a lot of, like, typical to your story, like 20s, 40s, 50s. We are skipping pretty quickly to get
right,
through.
We can come back and do that. Yeah,
we can circle back, but we're not going to get bleak. This is where all the fun begins, right? So the fun begins of now it's made. When you guys start cutting it together, and you talked about the terrific editor, William Bill Goldenberg, who, I mean, I'm just going to quickly click on his resume and shout out some films.
Let me comment on his resume, because you're now going to go through a list of my favorite films ever made and also The Imitation Game. Like, Billy is a god.
Yeah, so let's just go. I mean, even from 95, Heat, Long Kiss Goodnight, Pleasantville, The Insider, Ali. He did National Treasure. He also edited Miami Vice, bless his heart. He did Gone Baby Gone. I mean, this is like Zero Dark Thirty, Argo.
Double nominated for Oscars that year for Argo and Zero Dark Thirty in the same year.
Yeah, crazy.
He's amazing. I'm so proud to now be able to call him. I mean, he was at my wedding. Like, he's really become my friend. And I'm so, because of Invitation. And honestly, as the writer, you know, I give him and Morton a world of credit for, after we shot the movie, we came back to LA to edit it, and I had sort of imagined, one hears about sometimes how writers are kind of pushed aside, either in a filmmaking process or sort of in a filming process or in a post-production process. And Morton and Billy were so kind and lovely and generous that they said to me, I guess I can tell the real story. The real story is that I'd gone through this kind of bad breakup and I was really depressed. And they were like, you seem really sad right now. Can we just give you an office in our post-production facility? And do you want to just come here every day so you can get out of the house? Because we really think, like, you're bumming us out, man. Get out of the house. Like, come to Imitation Game Post every day. So, and I was finishing what became my second novel then. So I just started, they gave me a little office in the Imitation Post shop. And I, across from Billy's office, and I just, you know, every day would sort of be in my office working on my book. And then Billy just said, look, man, I'm leaving my door open. Come lay on my couch and watch me cut this movie. And we like having you here. You seem to be kind of value add to have you around. And I can honestly tell you that, like, you were asking when the fun started. I can tell you that I have to this day learned more about what cinema is from sitting on Billy Goldenberg's couch, watching him edit Imitation Game over a couple months than the entire rest of my life combined. Watching how Billy thinks of, looks at footage, puts together footage, looks at a scene, watching how Billy thinks about performance, thinks about crafting performance in an editorial experience is just a profound lesson in how to think about drama. And working with the script, changing things, but understanding why he's changing them and to sort of talk through watching Billy watch footage and sort of suddenly hit the space bar and stop because it's, oh, that's the front, the scene starts on this frame. This is the starting frame of the scene. I'm starting here. Okay, this is the starting frame. I still remember there was one of the huge lessons I learned that in that experience that I will never forget is there'd been a bit where we'd been a bit in the script where Keira Knightley's character had given this monologue about her parents. It was all about her relationship with her parents. And the audience may be listening to this going, huh, I don't remember her character giving a monologue about her relationship with her parents. Wait to the end of this brief anecdote, because I'm going to explain why it's not in the film, thanks to one Billy Goldenberg. And that's the genius of the editorial process. But so we had this monologue, and frankly, it was never quite working. Like there was no bit of that script that I didn't, I probably did more rewrites on that monologue than anything in the script. We'd done an extensive week rehearsal period before shooting, a couple weeks, and we, Kira kept saying, like, ah, some of the monologue is not working. And we all kind of felt like something was a little odd. Yeah, it's a little off. Okay, I'll do another version. Yeah, it's still not working. Okay, do another version. Yeah, it's still not working. Okay, do another version. So we're going through, we started to push that scene later into the shooting schedule because we just knew the monologue wasn't quite landing, but it was really important. And then get to the day, it's frustrating. Like I'd done so many versions of it, but still feel like it wasn't landing. Kira felt like she hadn't quite nailed it. Like everyone's just feeling like, okay, this is okay, but it's not there. Like it's just something isn't quite is it too long? Is it too short? Blah, blah, blah. We just kept doing different versions of it. And then we was even such a topic of conversation that I remember we saved the bit of wall behind Kira's head as she delivers it and carried it to other sets. Because we were like, oh, maybe we'll do just that, just do her close up again, and just put up that wall behind her to redo her close up for that monologue because we're not landing. Never figured it out. Get back to LA. Billy queues up his first, here, I'll play through an assembly, queues it up. Sure enough, the monologue's not in. And I go and it's, oh, huh. Billy, what's actually we've spent like immeasurable percentage of my life trying to figure out this monologue. And now it's just not in the movie. What happened? And he goes, oh, see, look, Graham, I'll show you. This is great. On the day, as we're filming it, one of the takes, she just starts the monologue with this big sigh, this, oh, my parents, and makes this face like, oh, it's a story and I'm not even going to get into it. And you see how frustrated she is. And Billy just goes, that face, that's all I need to see. When you see how frustrated she is and the implication that there's this whole story there that you're not going to get into is so much more evocative than actually hearing the story. And I'm tearing my hair. I remember freaking out and going, oh my God, I'm the worst writer in the world. You're right. Like, why did I spend so much time on this monologue? We didn't even need it. You're right. Like her face is so much more evocative there. And I remember him, he turned off his Avid for a second and he turned over to me and he said, Graham, no, this is the process. Like the fact that you wrote 1,000, this doesn't mean you're doing a bad job. This means you're doing a good job because you're writing 1,000 versions of that monologue. And Kira feeling the frustration of it and her expressing that frustration on her face in that take, that's the moment that's in the film. And my job is just to look at all this and say, that's all you need. And all the work you did to get there is your job. And it fundamentally like changed for everything since, for my second film, The Outfit, which Billy edited, we talked so much about the idea that the function of the script is to give the actors the tools they need to do their best work. That's it. And that is Billy Goldenberg's attitude
A
for.
terrific, it's not the topic of conversation today, but The Outfit is a terrifically restrained, twisty, great little movie, a nice unexpected gem. And you can, if you're hearing that anecdote about giving the actors enough so that they can express what they're feeling, the whole movie is that lesson. The whole movie is people not saying things, basically. I don't want to spoil the outfit, which is terrific. I want people to go and watch it. But I'm just saying it tracks. That feedback tracks in your work in a really good way.
I appreciate that. And that was something Billy came to do outfit very kindly with me. And I think that was something, yes, we talked about so much that, you know, Billy's such a master. I mean, you see this in from certainly in Heat, but in The Insider, in you see it a lot in Argo, where like, the story, and Zero Dark is another good example of this. Billy talks about this all the time. The story is not on the person speaking. The story is on the person listening. What I want to watch is someone receiving information and try to figure out do I believe what I'm being told? Am I being lied to? Do I think this is bullshit? You know, Billy is such a master of, it's not reaction shots. It's someone listening and processing what the audience is also hearing and deciding how they think or feel about that information.
Yeah.
Speaking
of The Insider, I think my personal favorite, I know that Heat, everyone, shock horror, is going to know that Heat is my favorite film, but I think his best work is The Insider.
Oh my God. Have you just blown up your whole podcast?
I would just say his best editing is The Insider, because that movie is 2,500 trapdoors. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how perilous an editing job is that? Like, I know you're a fan too, Graham. So I know you, even just thinking about conceptually as a writer, of like all the trapdoors that are there for you to fall in that movie, and how tonally it's a perfect movie and it all holds together and has a long running time, and it's over so many locations and so many things and so many states of mind and so many interior perspectives to tackle. And it just hangs together so effortlessly. I think that's, I mean, look, we're talking inches, but like, it's his best work for me. It's incredible.
Oh my God. I mean, it should be incomprehensible, and somehow.
Totally. And even imitation. When you just lay out multiple timelines happening, anchored perspectives, I want to tell it like a puzzle because it's about the world's greatest mathematician cryptographer in history. And you're telling that, it should be incomprehensible. But when he tonally does it, yours is like a dance. Imitation Game, it's like effortless. You don't even see him there, but it's like what he's doing with what's there is magical. And that's a credit to your script too, because it allows to be a waltz rather than something that's hard, 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 hard. It's not like that. It just flows.
That's kind of you to say, and I appreciate it. I'll give a lot of, you talked about the flow of it. That's something I'll give Billy and also, I mean, our director Morton, a world of credit for. I remember being on set. This is this little shot. You'd never remember. This is not an iconic shot from Imitation Game. This is a nothing little shot. It's in the 40 storyline. There's a scene where Alan Benedict's character goes to Joan, Keira Knightley's character's parent. She goes to her parents' house and he's trying to recruit her to join the team. And this is a little thing that you would never, I'm going to be saying this and everyone's going to listen to it going, no one's going to remember the shot, but I'm speaking of it for a reason. He goes to he's going to go to the parents' house, and there's this little beat of when you introduce the parents' house, you don't introduce it through an establishing shot outside. You're inside the front door.
You're inside the front door and you see Joan walk in the door.
You do. Oh my God. You remember this little nothing.
I remember. Yes.
So I remember distinctly being on set for that shot. And this is one of those days, you know, we're there and we're in the little house. It's just a shot of her walking through the door. Like no one's, the temperature's low on set. This is not a sort of high velocity shooting day, right? It's just Keira walking through a door. I remember I'm at the monitors with some of the producers and we're all chatting, and Morton comes over and he shows us the shot, which is this push in on the door before she opens it. It pushes in, she opens the door and reveals sort of what she hears. And Morton sort of goes, oh, did you see, look at the shot, look at what I'm setting up, look at the push in and then she's gonna open the door. And we're going, yeah, man, cool, great, push it on the door, then she opens it, we love it. Anyway, and then, you know, we're chatting, and Morton's like, no, but we're gonna push in before the door opens. And we're going, yeah, man, cool, okay, great, the shot of everybody, like, this doesn't seem that eventful. And he got so frustrated and he just went, oh, you guys, No one understands. You think this just happens. You think this flow just happens. No, the push-in starts before she opens the door. And let me tell you why the push-in starts before she opens the door. And it's because this is the only moment in the 40s storyline that is technically not told from Alan Turing's perspective. This is the one little thing, because you enter with her. It's the only time you enter with her. And so it's the only time we're actually breaking, we have this really rigid perspective rule for the whole movie. This is the one time we're going to break it. And he said, and it's okay, because what I'm doing is I'm moving the camera before you see her. So we're briefly going into a godlike perspective. The camera is leaving Alan's perspective, doing its own thing, and then she opens the door. And now the camera moves with her body to indicate that we're going to get this one little bit from her perspective. Then as soon as the scene's over, we're back to focusing on Alan and moving the camera with his body. And in the end, for him going like, you think it just flows. You watch the movie at the end of the day, you guys all think, oh, it just happens. It just happens. No, it does not just happen. It happened because I planned this. So when you speak of the kind of intelligibility of the flow, I think very much of Morton saying that, and how right he was, that being so meticulous about perspective, about why we're getting things, about sort of whose perspective we're getting each scene from and each storyline from, was really important to us in kind of making the three timelines intelligible.
Let's go to the film is released. What's your favorite screening experience of this movie?
Oh man, that is a lovely question. What is my favorite screening experience? I mean, the first time we showed it was at Telluride. And that was something we were so nervous because we just finished it a couple weeks before. Oh, there was the whole thing about whether we're even going to be able to finish it in time for to release that fall. We didn't initially think we were going to, and we'd had we were quite late in the process. Alexandre Desplat, our wonderful composer, did that score in 13 days to make this deadline. It was wild.
You hear about all these master composers that like do stuff in 6 days, 5 days, 13 days, and you're like, how did you make this thing that just, and that score, the score is the movie, the score.
Oh, no, it's, yeah, I cannot imagine without Alexander's her score. And believe me, it's funny. I mean, Billy, I joked to Billy about this, because Billy, the score to Prisoners, the Denis Villeneuve movie, was our temp score for a lot of the editorial process.
Wow.
Billy loves it. I mean, it's an amazing score. The Prisoner's score. Just an amazing score. So I think it was before Alexandre came on, so we were still sort of editing some temp, and Billy's so good at this, at finding like really strange comps to use for editing so that we know it's different enough from what we're going to eventually use that it's not fighting against what we're going to do.
And it's not stepping on the toes of what you want to produce either.
Yes, like we're not going to Alexandra and saying like, hey man, can you recreate Prisoners? Like that's not what this is. Right.
That's a different score.
That's
a different movie, I think, completely.
Yeah, that is a super different movie. But it's funny, there's still scenes of it where I like hear the Prisoners score. I adore Prisoners and have seen it a number of times since we finished Imitation. And I still, every time I see Prisoners, I'm like, this score plays really different when you see it in Prisoners. Like, it's so dark.
Yeah, the content's just a little bit different. It's like Seven in a suburb, you know, like it's dark, that movie.
Yeah, you're like, oh man, he's really torturing him with the hot water in the shower. And it's burning off his skin. The score, something I've now learned about the Prisoners score, not as dark as you might think. If you listen to it and into the picture, it's a little bit more kind of uncertain in its tone. But so... yeah, Alex, it was this mad dash to finish everything. Alexandra like quickly came in. It was a very, you go to someone like him because he just sits at his piano and is like, great, how about this? No? Okay, how about this? No? Okay, how about this? And then he kind of caught on this idea really, really quickly of, okay, you know, one of Morton's aesthetic principles for the film that I think Morton should get more credit than he gets for this, is that Morton had this idea aesthetically that the movie should feel out of time. He always said, I want the audience to be unclear about what decade this film was made in.
Yeah.
Like nothing, you know, we made it in 2013. And he was always kind of like, I don't want anything to feel kind of 2013. I don't want anything to feel 2003. I don't want anything to feel 1993. Nothing feels 1983. Like, it's nothing quite tells you when it was made. It's why we shot on 3 perf 35 millimeter film. It's why there's a lot of kind of camera stuff that was forbidden to us because it was sort of too modern. And then with the score, Alexandre kind of took that idea and said, okay, great, let's use only instruments that would have been around in 1950, but let's not use them the way you would have used them in 1950. So the main theme is you listen to it once and you think it's just a piano. It's not. It's three pianos that have been digitally altered off of each other a little bit. It's unplayable. It's the same. It's this piano thing that you need sort of three tracks of piano to be able to do that have been slightly moved apart from each other in a way that human fingers couldn't do. And Alexander kind of harped on that idea very quickly of like, okay, yes, let's use pianos and strings and kind of very typical film instruments, but then I'm going to digitally do slightly weird things to them that human beings couldn't do. And that's kind of the whole theme of the score. So I had honestly never even heard the final mix before. We go to Telluride. I remember being on the plane to Telluride. You asked about the screening. I remember I'm on the plane and I'd never been to Telluride before. I ended up sitting next to a film journalist who's sort of, oh, what are you there for? And I said, oh, my name's Graham. I wrote this movie, Imitation Game. It's premiering tomorrow. And he's like, oh yeah, I heard of that. Cool. Good luck, kid. I hope people like it. Maybe I'll show up. Maybe I'll show up. And we just had we'd never really shown it to people before. Like no one had any idea if anyone was gonna like it. Like I'd never been in a theater. None of us had been in a theater with people watching it before. So we do that. We have our first
Who
screening.
was there? So you're in Telluride. Was Morton was there?
Yeah, Morton was sitting
Morton was
next to
there.
me.
Were Ben and Kira there?
Gosh, now I'm trying to remember. Did they come to Telluride? No, they met us in Toronto
They
the
were in
next.
TIFF because the imitation for you guys had such a splash at TIFF. I think that was the first time I'd heard of the film, was the response out of TIFF at the time in 2014 was monstrous. And so, yeah, Telluride was your first one.
Yeah, TIFF was like our like Zeppelin in 74, just like how the West was won. That felt like this insane. And I think we became because Telluride went well, then we got a better slot into. Although no, I think that's right. There was this whole thing about how we were not getting a good slot at TIFF, and someone was upset about it, and something. It clearly worked out fine.
Tell us
But
about that Telluride screening. You're sitting down.
we sit down, and Morton's there, and I think everyone was stressed about some. Everyone's stressed about whatever dumb thing. I don't even remember what it was. I remember we're all really stressed. And I saw the critic who I'd met on the airplane, or the journalist who I'd met on the airplane, and he was sort of a couple rows behind us, and I like waved to the guy, oh, you're sitting down, okay, he's watching the movie, and I'm next to Morton and producers, and we're all, we kind of settle in. And I just remember that screen was deathly quiet. I mean, the whole last half of that movie was deathly quiet in the screening. You could hear a pin drop, and I was dying. I think I like squeezed Morton's arm so hard he had to push me away at some point because I was freaking out so badly because it felt like such a disaster. So quiet. And the movie ends, lights come up, and there's like applause. Let's say there was applause. It was not a deafening roar by any stretch of the imagination. It was some applause. And I am, as usual, crying. I was like, oh my God, this is, I just spent like how many years of my life on this thing, and it was a disaster. Like, I can't believe this went so badly. And Morton and I kind of stand up and we look behind me, and I just remember this so well. The journalist who I'd met the night before on the plane, I catch eyes with him and he is sobbing, like ugly sobbing, tears behind me. And I realized that everyone is, it was quiet because everyone was crying so hard. And that was my first moment of, oh, maybe this wasn't a disaster after all.
So good. So good. I love that you're like, it's over for me. I'm crying. All my time is wasted. But the right response happened, which is that
Yeah, it was
everyone
just,
is moved to tears.
yeah, you sort of don't know, you kind of don't know how like emotionally people respond to it. Like, are they gonna cry? Do we want them to cry? You don't really know. And I think, throughout even the writing and the filming, and frankly through the editorial process, you sort of never know we're always just saying like, okay, what do we like? What do we enjoy here? What do we think is really interesting? What are other people going to think? And I remember Morton turning to me at some point through that and just saying, with some trepidation, he says, "Graham, I just, is this movie going to be the first line in our obituaries?" And I remember that so vividly. I still think about it like, oh God, is that movie going to be the first line in my obituary? I don't.
Yeah, it
probably.
Is.
That's terrifying. Is that terrifying? I think I still like look at this. For
yeah,
the
it's terrifying. Yeah, it's terrifying because when you hit with anything and it's the first thing, it's like your skill set's going to change and you're going to be a more accomplished author and you're going to be a way better screenwriter and filmmaker and you're going to take the reins of a film yourself and you're going to do it. But you can't predict if the first thing is going to resonate and smash people's guts. Like you're never going to know. Like I think of people like, you know, some of my favorite filmmakers, like the Coens, Blood Simple, you know, like Shallow Grave, Danny Boyle, like thank God he made Trainspotting because now that's that, you know what I'm saying? It's like, because otherwise that's it. That's all you've got. Like Barry Jenkins, is it going to be Moonlight? Yeah, probably. That's the thing that's going to be there. Like it's undeniable at this point. So it's so hard. You kind of just go, but I mean, man, what an obit.
Sure, there's better things. Yeah, I guess another way of looking at it is like, well, look, man, now we get to have obituaries when we die. It's like we made this one thing that people really, really like.
Yeah.
But it's wild to think. It's funny. Like I still feel today that I need to, in such competition with Imitation Game. Like I have to be able to do better than that. I know I could do better than that. I mean, I sit down. We're talking today and. You can see me sitting at my desk. I'm sitting here at my desk with material in front of me that I'm working on right now. And I need to believe that it's going to be better than that. Like I need to believe that I'm getting better and that there's better work still in store for me, even if that might be my biggest hit. Like I can't control that, right?
In the most tiny and insignificant and pale in comparison way, no one would have ever even, especially someone like you, an Academy Award winning writer, as much as you might like shy away at your plaudits, you would never have done this show if it wasn't for One Heat Minute.
If I had not been a huge fan of One Heat Minute as a heat obsessive, I guess really Goldberg about every single moment of heat, you're right.
But what I'm saying is like, we've done so many shows, but the first thing is it's One Heat Minute. It's One Heat Minute Productions. Like
yeah.
That's what it is. It's like, I can't ever say how much that experience meant to me. And I'm hearing you talking about your experience and I can see it. That experience was like formative in a crazy way that things are formative and you're going to stretch and you're going to push yourself, but you guys should be totally flattered. Maybe Morton, because he's like, I made one of the greatest headshot, disgusting, you know, movies of all time. Maybe he's less happy about Imitation being on that, but I think I think that's the coolest thing. And that like that, the whole point of the Decade Project is to talk about the stuff that's still resonating. And I think that lost in amongst my son calls them the aisles.
The aisles?
The aisles of streaming, you know, like he goes, Dad, can you go to the other aisle? The other aisle, right? So that I get instructions, go to the next aisle. But what I would say to you is when I think about your work, it's like, that's exactly why we do the Decade Project. Cause I'm keen to talk about the stuff that still resonates to me. And like literally when I was thinking last year about continuing this process and maybe reaching out to some filmmakers to talk, like The Imitation Game was in one of the aisles of Australian Netflix or one of our streamers. I don't know which one. I'm like, I haven't seen The Imitation Game in 8. And I watched it and I was like, this movie freaking rules. Like it's great. Like obviously it still stands up terrifically. And I think even Keira Knightley, she's in another 2014 movie, less good, but nonetheless, was quite good, is Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit. And my friend Connor goes, why does Keira Knightley feel like she's got other things on her mind? And I said, she was in The Imitation Game. That's why she had other things on her mind that year. She was excited about The Imitation Game, you know, where she gets to play Joan Clark, a freaking excellent character in that movie. So she was probably thinking about that. So It's kind of incredible. I love that your favorite screening was the one that you were the most uncertain. That says so much about you, Graham. It's so
yeah, fun. I know. It's really bad. I'm not good. You may have noticed I'm not good with compliments. I like winning people over. Maybe that's what it is. Like going into a screening where I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if people are going to like this. Maybe everyone's going to hate it. And then feeling like they did hate it. And then, we got them. Like we did get them right at the end of it is really exciting to me. And it feels like, because it was us sort of saying, here's this little thing that we just made in the winter in England one time. And I'm still, and maybe this is going to be incomprehensible to everyone. And, you know, certainly there were early cuts that were kind of incomprehensible to a lot of people. So that people got into it by the end of that experience. Yes, that's the one I remember. More than anything else.
When I talk to guests on this show who aren't part of creating the text, we talk about sliding doors. And one of the questions I was going to ask right at the beginning was there anyone else but Benedict? But you'd sort of answered that. But you have an amazing cast. I love Matthew Good. Around this time, Matthew Good made one of my favorite Australian films, directed by a guy by the name of Jonathan Teplitsky. It is called, I want to make sure I can single out the year so that people can chase it down. It's probably going to be hard to find out. So he made like Match Point. You guys would hear about that. He obviously makes The Watchmen much later. But it is called Burning Man from 2011, which is one of my favorite.
I have not seen Burning Man. I don't know it.
Burning Man, Matthew Good, terrific movie about a self-destructive chef. And I genuinely think, one of my friends and I in Australia talk about like, if that had like an Academy Award winning Academy Award level campaign, it could have totally been like a gigantic movie, but it was just like a little indie Aussie movie that got great reviews and was really well directed. But
I have to find it. Matthew Good is amazing. I mean, he was so great and he really did that. I give Matt a ton of credit for coming in. You know, that he was a pretty, like, at that point in his career, he came and took a pretty small part in Imitation Game. Like, that's a flashy part, but he's not in that many scenes if you really look at it. He's an old friend of Benedict's, and he's really someone who came in, they're old friends, and honestly, I think in some ways he did it as a favor, but he also came in really understanding what it was, and, okay, I'm going to take this kind of small part here because I know that what Benedict's going to do here is going to be unreal. And I like, he's perfect for this. And like, I need to like come in and help.
Kira is so underrated in this movie too. She's, as Joan, is maybe some of her best work ever.
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, I adore her. It's so easy to sort of talk about these great, I feel like I can't take any credit for, oh my God, Keira Knightley's amazing. Yeah. Keira Knightley's amazing. She was always so, even sort of through the we had a long rehearsal process, before we started shooting. And in some ways that was actually the most fun I had, in the filming process. I mean, if I could just be in a rehearsal room with Benedict and Kira and Matthew Good, or if I had been in that rehearsal room for the last 10 years, I would be thrilled. Never had to actually shoot the movie. Just getting to sort of do the scenes and getting to play around. And they're also, they've all done enough theater that they're really excited about a rehearsal process and they can like, let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. Let's play around here. Let's play around there. I mean, I think we all had so much fun doing that and learning from that process and kind of like digging around and poking at each other. I was so grateful to get to do it.
Finally, were there any other sliding doors moments? Was Mark Strong always going to be your MI5 representative? Because I feel like there's a couple of huge actors that are there. You guys have got Charles Dance, who's amazing in this movie. You've got Mark Strong, and I'm like, Mark Strong is just like a cure-all. Like, have him on the bench for any role, and he's gonna crush. Like, he can do something as silly as The Kingsman. He can do, I mean, he can do kind of like Tinker Tailor. He can do this. Like, he's just, I mean, he was on the bench for Javier Bardem's role in No Country for Old Men. If Javier wasn't going to do it, it was going to be Mark Strong. I'm like,
oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that. He would have been amazing.
As Anton Chigurh, he would have been amazing. He just can't. Yeah.
Mark Strong, my friend, I have had so many conversations around Los Angeles where I try to get someone to explain to me why Mark Strong is not like the biggest A-list actor in the world. He's such a beast. He's so wonderful. He, 'cause he, and he's so subtle. I mean, he barely does anything. I remember we were doing the scene. I honestly, I can't. I would tell you if there was someone else we were going to cast instead of Mark, but I don't even remember any other conversations. I'm sure it was like, well, Mark Strong is never going to come in for this, and very small part. He doesn't. That's another part where he says very little. He has very few lines.
Yes.
Every one of them is a joke, like some sort of sly, like blowing off the gravity of the situation in front of them. But he's you keep watching him listening to things. He's so observant, and Mark Strong does listening very closely, as well as any actor I've ever seen before. There was he's on such a I remember we were doing the scene oh towards the end when he Benedict comes into Keira Knightley, Joan Clark's her flat in the end of the 40 storyline, and he finds Benedict walks in to find Mark Strong's there, and he's rifling through the drawers, and Mark Strong's found the encrypted messages that they'd taken out of Bletchley some time ago. And Benedict knows she's in trouble and he's in trouble, and Mark Strong is sort of manipulating him. And I remember so vividly doing that scene on that day, and it was honestly one of those moments where it was one of the few times I got a little worried, because we start doing it and Mark Strong speaks so slowly. Every line is delivered like this, and then he takes these really long pauses between the points that he's making. And I remember going, he's returning to Martin, which I remember turning to Morton saying, oh man, Mark's being so, and he's barely speaking, and everything, you're not even gonna hear me if I do it at the whisper that Mark Strong does every line with. It's just the things at a whisper. And I was like, Morton, is that like, is this gonna work? And Morton just goes, no, I'll show you what he's doing. Watch Billy send us back the footage. And Mark is so great at calibrating his performance to the edit that like the pauses are perfectly timed for when we know we're gonna be cutting around and editing anyway. Like it's time for the edit of the film and what he knows we're gonna do with it. That's how great it is. That was
He's literally like an editor's wet dream. He's just calibrating himself to like, here's where you put the edit around me.
yes, I'm gonna give you all the space in the world. I'm gonna let you see me thinking. I know you're not gonna cut in the middle of the line. I know that and he also knew the movie it was. And Mark's always he's so present and so listening that he knows that when Benedict's talking frequently, that's when he's doing something. That's when we need to see him listening. There's this little bit I did to talk more about Mark Strong. A couple scenes. Oh, it's a couple scenes before that. There's this bit where Benedict and Kira go to meet him in a little tea shop in London after they've broken the code. And I remember my favorite like little bit of Mark Strong acting that I just I'm obsessed with. They're in the tea shop. They tell him the whole plan. We've broken the code. This is what we want to do. And Mark Strong, like a piece of, he rolls his own cigarette and he like takes his time lighting the cigarette between
Is it
lines.
is
And
it is it when he is it when he pulls the tobacco out of
yes, he
his
pulls the tobacco
lip?
out of his lip. Like the tobacco just stuck to his lip in the one scene, and he does it between lines. It's between a thing, and it just actually stuck to his lip, and so he delivers the one line. And then he very slowly plucks the tobacco out, sets it on the table, and delivers the next line. And you do that. I mean, I know Billy is an editor. I know him well now enough to know that any time anything strange like that happens, you go like, oh, Billy's putting this in the movie. This is absolutely
Yeah,
like anytime someone.
perfect like encapsulation of reality and spontaneity is staying. It's staying with us.
Yes. Every time it became a joke, like every time somebody dropped something. Dropped a prop, that's in the movie. Every time somebody trips a little bit, that's in the movie. I mean, that is a Billy Goldenberg editing. You see this a lot. Like they move in a strange way. Like anything that feels real, like it's not acting. Like they're making, I know one of the rules we talk about a lot is like if it feels like the actor is sort of making a mistake, that's in the movie.
Yeah.
If a line comes out weirdly because they're sort of hadn't this isn't what they imagined saying, but now they suddenly find themselves saying it. that's in the movie because that's real. And that was, yeah, certainly among the things I learned making that.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for your part in this movie. I think it is terrific. I think it's a fitting obit for both you and Morton if you guys like much, much, much later in 50 years.
thank you for projecting a long life for us.
It's 50 years. It's allowed to be the first line on your obit. I think it's a terrific film. I'm so honored to talk to you about it. It's amazing. I think the story of the film's success and is well documented, so I don't think we need to tread over that well-worn territory, but it has been an absolute thrill talking to you about making it, your first reaction to it, the fact that it is still sticking around and informing, and you're sort of chasing, you know, creatively and aspirationally chasing that dragon. It's so amazing. And I just wanted everyone who's listening to thank me for my restraint, because do you know how fun it would be for me to talk exclusively to Graham about the Billy Goldenberg Heat stories on a show and just occupy all of the time of this episode talking about that? But instead we talked about this terrific movie, The Imitation Game, terrific performances, the crazy and almost, you know, beautiful osmosis of it all happening. And I just want to say thank you so much again for doing this, Graham. This has been a blast talking to you.
I really appreciate it, Blake. This has been it's been a delight. I'm so glad the movie is remembered and remembered fondly, and that you're still talking about it. Yes, and hopefully my obituary is at least a few days out.
A few decades out.
When you do your centennial project, we'll come back in 100 years and see if this. I vow to you now. I'm excited to go try and make something that beats this for the first line in my own memory.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.